I asked for you to read four books for this week of The City of God. We're going to read these four books this week, today we'll read through book one, and then I'm going to kind of give you some background on books two through nine, but then we'll talk about book ten tomorrow, and then on Wednesday we'll talk about book 15. It's a kind of takes us deep into Augustine's figural imagination for thinking about the two cities through the Bible. And then we'll come to the Locus Classicus, book 19, which discusses the relationship between the faith and politics. So today, we're going to look at his first book. His first book was his opening gambit to the charge. As you'll see in the first lines of book one, he's writing to my dear Marcellinus. Anybody know who Marcellinus is?
Marcellinus?
No. He's a North African proconsul of the Roman Empire who is a Christian, Catholic, and he is hearing from many of the Roman elites that the sack of Rome is really due to Christianity. That Christianity has made Rome weak. Now, a little backstory on Rome. Of course, Rome is a persecuting power for Christians for hundreds of years. And then, of course, in 325, by Nicaea, we have evidence that Constantine, with the Edict of Milan earlier in 313, Christianity is a kind of established religion of the empire. By 360, Julian the Apostate, an emperor, is trying to roll things back towards polytheism, to the gods of our ancestors. By the 380s, we have Theodosius, an emperor who is smashing all of the shrines to the ancestral gods. That's a bit of background. By 410, we have Goths from the north and the south on mass migration patterns. And that leads to the most immediate problem that the Goths, the Visigoths, Alaric, the king of the Visigoths, attacks Rome. Now, Rome is no longer the sole bastion of the imperial administrative life. That's moved to Constantinople after Constantine. In some respects, it's moved to Milan. So Rome is no longer the sole center, but it's still an important symbol. And the symbol is that it's the eternal city. It's a city which represents the end of history, to borrow from Francis Fukuyama. That Rome is the end of history. That Rome is a kind of eternal city that is permanent in the world. So to see Rome attacked by the Goths shook the confidence. Our closest analog in America is probably something like 9/11, in which we started to think about, well, maybe we're not invulnerable, right? Maybe we're not invulnerable. Maybe there's something which is causing this existential suffering. And so book one is Augustine's attempt to answer Marcellinus, to answer his Christian friend, who is an agent of the Republic, about the suffering of the Republic. The Republic is suffering. And as any of us know, when we suffer, we look for reasons for why we suffer. And the elites are looking to Christianity as the reason for why Rome is suffering. I have taken upon myself the task of defending the glorious city of God, in the Latin it's the most glorious city of God, against those who prefer their own gods to the founder of that city. From the outset in the preface, Augustine's announcing his intention to focus on the charge made that it's monotheism, Christian monotheism, which is to blame, and Roman polytheism, which is going to get Rome back on track, make Rome great again by going back to the ancestral gods. And he says, I know how great is the effort to convince the proud of the power and excellence of humility. Now, this is a really important line. It keys us into something, a dynamic in Augustine, a moral dynamic, that tries to persuade Romans that actually the key to human flourishing is the humility which recognizes that we have to receive everything from God. And we must receive everything from the one God. And this is the necessary condition for actually receiving the truth that comes to us in Jesus Christ. So that humility is the fundamental virtue of Christianity is also taking on the objection that comes from Roman elites, that actually humility is the thing which has made Rome weak. See, humility is a kind of weakness. What you need is glory and power and honor. And so Augustine's very concerned from the beginning to take that criticism very seriously and to turn it in on itself and say, no, actually, humility is what's going to make Rome great again. Humility is what's going to make Rome a happy, flourishing republic or a more happy, flourishing republic. And humility is not the cause of its suffering, but the cause of its healing, that would be the cause of its healing if it could be received. So that pride-humility pair that comes right up front on the first page is extremely important for understanding Augustine's argument. And a lot of Book 1 is like that. A lot of Book 1 gives you kind of clues for reading all 22 books of the City of God. The first half, Books 1 through 10, is an argument with Roman history and about their attachment to the gods and how the gods harm their moral life and their political life. And books 11 through 22 are taking the Romans into biblical history, into divine revelation, and showing them two cities. Often we think of the two cities as something which is belongs mainly to books 11 through 22, because the two cities, as we'll see when we read book 15, is very much a biblical idea. The contrast between Jerusalem and Babylon, for example, is a biblical idea, and that's at the heart of two cities language. But I want to suggest to you for your reading of book 1 today that the two cities is very much present in the first 10 books, and you can see it right here two examples that we're going to review, the example of Lucretia and the example of Regulus, which we'll talk about, as examples of what he says in Book 5 are shadowy resemblances of the two cities. They're shadowy resemblances of the city of man, a city which falls on its own standard, and a city of God which lives according to a transcendent standard. This is the basic two cities model, but you can see it in Roman history itself. I cannot refrain from speaking of the city of this world, the earthly city, the Terrena Civitate, a city which aims at dominion, which holds nations in enslavement, but is itself dominated by that very lust of domination, libido dominandi. The introduction of the city of man, or the more properly the earthly city, or the city of this world, indicates right from the outset that Augustine's interested in teaching the Roman world about this other pair. Pride and humility, city of man, city of God, or city of the world, city of God. A worldly city or a godly city. And pride and humility map beautifully onto that, right? A city which puffs up, which is aimed at dominion, at domination, versus a city which recognizes that it is a gift from God. So there we see the pair right in the preface. The preface gives us that crucial emphasis on pride and humility. It gives us the crucial emphasis on two cities. From this world city, he says in the first chapter of book 1, From this world's city there arise enemies against whom the city of God has to be defended. Though many of these correct their godless error and become useful citizens of that city. This is another important theme that comes out repeatedly in Augustine's treatment of the city of God, is this attention to conversion. And an attention to the footholds for conversion in Roman thought. There's a kind of potted Protestant story of Augustine being Calvin Redivivus, or Calvin, not Redivivus, but Calvin avant la lettre, that somehow he thinks that human moral life is vitiated all the way through and that there's no virtue. I think we're going to see that he doesn't think that. That there are acquired earthly virtues which are imperfect, but are nevertheless virtues. From this world city there arise enemies, but these enemies can be corrected. And he's going to show how they can be corrected on their own terms, be corrected by their own arguments. And so he's going to present different Roman thinkers, Varro, Livy, Virgil, Horace, and of course Cicero, as evidence that they have virtues. And we're going to see that especially in Regulus. In the first section here, and then we'll talk about Lucretia and Regulus, we can see his attention to the suffering of Roman people. Rome is attacked. The buildings are more or less left intact. Rome doesn't really suffer a physical. There's no twin towers that are destroyed. But the people are raped, murdered. Things are stolen. Great treasures are stolen. But he marks a new custom in these Visigoths who come. And the new custom is that they don't destroy the Christian shrines and altars. Now, this is interesting to the Roman reader because this is the custom. The custom is when you go into a city, the first thing you do is destroy the shrines and altars. Why do you do that? Because their world is not secular. Their whole world is infused with religious life. You want to hit the city, you hit the gods. The gods are protectors of that city. If you show that you have struck the gods, then you show that you have domination over the city. Not even the gods can protect you. We've shown that manifestly. And Augustine says, but that didn't happen here, did it? The Goths, when they came in, they respected the Christian shrines and altars. Why did they do that? Because they fear the true God. Now, it turns out that the Visigoths are mostly Arians. But Augustine seems either unaware or unconcerned that they're Arians. What is important about the Visigoths is that they respect the true God. It's an argument for monotheism, that the one true God is being respected, is being feared. And so the critique is already being pushed back. If Christianity has made Rome so weak, why do our enemies not touch our shrines and altars? Couldn't be that weak, right? Because this never happens in any other mode. And so we see this new custom, all the devastation, the butchery, the plundering, the conflagrations, and all the anguish which accompanied the recent disaster of Rome were in accordance with the general practice of what warfare. But there was something which established a new custom. Something which changed the whole aspect of the scene, he writes. The savagery of the barbarians took on such an aspect of gentleness, of mercy, that the largest basilicas were filled with people to be spared by the enemy. This introduces the city of God aspect in Rome. How does the city, we know how the worldly city works. It works on libido dominandi, the lust for power. It works on pride. How does the obedient city look? Well, the obedient city provides sanctuary. It provides shelter. The obedient city is a city which is providing protection. So here's the city of humility, which is actually a city which protects, which guards, which safeguards. And it safeguards by the power of God. And this is what spares the Roman people from the enemy. So this is a kind of structural thing that is built in right from the outset of the first book. Two cities, or shadowy resemblances of the two cities we're going to see in the Roman history, but then also a more literal two cities in terms of the presence of the church, which is the city of God on pilgrimage in this world, and the city of man. Both Christians and pagans suffered together in the attack. Roman women were raped. Christian women were raped. How, as a bishop, as a pastor, do you respond to that? Do you act like a therapist? Or do you act like a theologian who is trying to give insight into what is the nature of suffering itself? And this is Augustine's preference, is to think about, okay, what is the nature of suffering? How does it affect people? And he says it affects all of us. All of us, the good and evil alike, all experience suffering. Rome has experienced an enormous suffering in this attack. How should we think about that? He says in the 8th chapter, a thesis is stated here that I think is worth remembering for the whole. The identity of the sufferings do not mean that there is no difference between them, the sufferings that the good and wicked alike suffer. Though the sufferings are the same, the sufferers remain different. And here's the key sentence. Virtue and vice are not the same, even if they undergo the same torment. What matters is the nature of the sufferer, not the nature of the sufferings. This is an important thesis that is put forward in the midst of Roman suffering, and it's going to come out especially in a contrast between a Republican hero named Lucretia and Christian women. Lucretia is a heroine of Roman history. Does anybody know the history of Rome, what Lucretia, her place in Roman history? You know, there's a monarchical period, and then a republican period, and then an imperial period in Roman history. It begins with the monarchical period, and at the end of the monarchical period, there's a great revolution, a republican revolution, to ban the vicious kings of Rome from Rome and begin a republic. And Lucretia is right at the heart of that. And so he introduces Lucretia as someone who, I don't know if it's like calling to mind Betsy Ross, it's calling to mind some early heroine of the Roman Republic. Lucretia suffers a grave evil, a kind of disaster to her person, and at the end of the monarchical period, she is her husband Collatinus and Prince Tarquin and others are off at battle at Ardea, not too far away, and they're talking around a campfire. I guess this was the kind of thing that men talked about whose wife was most virtuous in Rome, and so they were competing with one another to tell, to praise their wives. And Collatinus wins the prize by praising his wife Lucretia. As Prince Tarquin hears about all the virtues of Lucretia, he becomes very interested. And there's some conflict about who really should win the prize, and they decide the only way Prince Tarquin says the only way we can really decide this is by going back to Rome, leaving the battle at Ardea, and going back to Rome and finding whatever state our wives are in will tell us how virtuous they are. and their domestic virtue will show us how they contribute to the virtue of Rome. Because the domestic virtues are important for the virtues of the city, they ride back and they find various princesses in various states of luxury, decadence, celebrations, eating grapes and wine, what have you. But what is Lucretia doing? Spinning wool. This is considered the most virtuous thing. Why? Because she's caring for the household. She's doing domestic activities which are good for the fabric of the family, and that is evidence of a virtue of the household that commends itself to the virtue of the Republic, because they, as men in battle, are caring for the fabric of the common good of Rome, and their wife, Collatinus's wife, is caring for the common good of the family. And this is the most virtuous thing, is caring for the common good of the family. Well, Prince Tarquin falls madly in lust with Lucretia, and they go back to Ardea, but Prince Tarquin sticks around and says, I need to spend the night here. I spend the night. So he gets a guest room in Collatinus's and Lucretia's home, and Lucretia served him dinner like a good hostess, and night falls, the servants of the household show him to his room. He goes to bed. Lucretia goes to bed. In the middle of the night, Prince Tarquin walks down the hall into Lucretia's room and gets on top of her and begs her to have conjugal relations with him, begs him to have sex. She says no, she refuses. He says, he doesn't threaten violence to her, he threatens violence initially to her slaves. I'm going to kill your slaves if you don't do this. She says no. He says, okay, well, if you don't have sex with me, what I'm going to do is I'm going to kill you and your slaves and make it look like you had sex with the slave. And your husband will come home and you'll have the dishonor of being dead in your bed as an adulteress if you don't have sex with him. And at that, she consents. She consents because she wants to protect her honor. The threat is actually a threat to her honor. And so Lucretia consents. Prince Tarquin rapes her. He leaves. Of course, Lucretia is devastated. Lucretia is devastated, as anyone would be. She sends for her father and for her husband, Collatinus. And they come. They rush. Collatinus, at least, is out at Ardea. They rush back to the home, and she tells them what has happened. And bursts into a discussion of if they're real men, they will seek vengeance on her behalf. Says, Collatinus, another man's seed is in our bed. You must take vengeance for me. This is all recorded in Livy. If you want to read Livy's histories, he gives a great recounting of Lucretia. Rome loved this story. The story was a story about the end of the monarchical period. It's a story about how the Roman kings were not just raping Lucretia, but the Roman kings were raping Rome. Right? The Roman kings were doing violence to the common good of Rome, and here's a particular Roman king or Roman prince doing violence to the domestic common good. So they love this story because it's emblematic. She tells the story and says, if you're men, you will seek vengeance on my behalf. And they say, of course we'll seek vengeance. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Sort of a Goodwill Hunting scene. And at that moment, she takes a dagger out from her dress and she plunges it into her chest. And this is the climax of the story. That she commits suicide. Why does she commit suicide right there? Because vengeance wasn't enough. She needed to prove her purity, prove her honor. And the only way to prove her honor was to show, I will sacrifice my life because of this suffering. Now, isn't that an amazing metaphor as well as a story? That the Romans looked to this story as emblematic of what Rome must do. It must make sacrifices in order to expunge some grave injustice. Right? and they expunge the kings. Collatinus gathers up his dead wife, takes her out into the forum, and gives an incredible speech. And this is the beginning of the Republican Revolution. Let's drive the kings out, right? This is a cause for political revolution, right? If the kings are doing this to the domestic common good, this is emblematic of what they're doing to the civil common good, and we must drive it out. And so Lucretia represents the beginning of the Republic, and this is why Augustine turns to her. Not just some random example. Hey, Lucretia. No, Lucretia is crucial because she stands as, in a sense, a founding myth. He's going to go to the founding myth. So, when a woman has been ravished without her consenting, he says in chapter 18, and forced by another's sin, she has no reason to punish herself by a voluntary death. Our opponents heap the highest praises for modesty upon Lucretia, a noble matron of antiquity. When King Tarquin's son had lustfully gained possession of her body, she destroyed herself. How was it that she who did not commit adultery received the heavier punishment? Why does Prince Tarquin just get banished from Rome? I mean, it's a bad punishment. He's no longer can rule Rome with his father, but he doesn't get the death penalty. Why does Lucretia, who suffered the grave injustice, get the most grave punishment? Augustine asks, why is this? And why would you admire this? Why would you think this is important for the Roman good? How was it that highly extolled Lucretia also did away with the innocent, chaste, outraged Lucretia? He's deeply, deeply sympathetic to Lucretia. Sometimes when my students read this text, they think he's somehow insensitive to her. He's not. He's defending her. If she is innocent, then she shouldn't have given herself the death penalty. She was not being virtuous, but rather she was ashamed of another's foul deed committed on her, even though not with her. That is, not with her real consent. And as a Roman woman excessively eager for honor, she was afraid that she should be thought to have willingly endured so violently what she so violently suffered. What Augustine is putting a stress on here is that for Lucretia, her virtue was the virtue of her honor, and she was defending her honor. If her homicide is extenuated, her adultery is established. If she is cleared of adultery, the murder is abundantly proved. There is no possible way out. If she is adulteress, why is she praised? If chaste, why was she put to death? He's kind of trapping the Roman reader. The Roman reader who wants to sympathize with her, right? Wants to sympathize with the grave injustice, must make a decision as to whether or not there was a graver injustice, or whether the death penalty that she meted out on herself was deserved. Right? So he's got his Roman reader in a kind of trap. Since she could not display, she wanted to display her pure conscience, she felt she must exhibit her pure conscience by her own punishment. Augustine enters into what is the first developed argument against suicide here. And he argues, interestingly, one of his most fascinating arguments from a Roman perspective is a legal argument that in Roman law, the death penalty can only be given by a judge. And so one of his most interesting arguments against suicide here is that she is actually, this is the judicial usurpation of politics. She's taken on her own judicial supreme. She's pope and judge and executioner all together. She's taking up the role of the justice, and this is improper and unjust and illegal. So that's a really interesting argument. But then, of course, he also argues that it's philosophically incoherent from a perspective of moral philosophy. This is incoherent to actually resolve an injustice by a greater injustice. Right? What she does is she increases the injustice by committing suicide for this great suffering. And then, of course, he gives the scriptural argument, thou shalt not kill, including yourself. So he gives various kinds of arguments, legal, moral, philosophical, theological, biblical arguments. It's the first developed argument against suicide. But it's important to see here that Augustine isn't just taking a random example. He's taking Lucretia is an example or a metaphor for the Republic itself. The Republic has also suffered this great devastation, this great violation. The Eternal City has been violated and is doing a greater injustice by, in a sense, turning its back on God. That's a kind of suicide, a kind of cultural suicide, to turn your back on God. Right? So Lucretia is an emblem, then. She's an emblem of the heart turned in on itself, a famous Augustinian theme, the city of pride. She's very proud, and so she looks to herself as the one who can resolve the great injustice. She looks to herself as the one who can solve the suffering. Right? And so she's the emblem of the city of this world. Right? Now, our Protestant friends will sometimes read this as Augustine's view of fallen morality, but this is how all of fallen morality. But there's another example that he gives which complicates that vision, which we'll talk about in a second. But I want to highlight how he very briefly in chapter 19, very briefly, alludes to a contrast. So Lucretius contrasted with the behavior of Christian women. He says, such has not been the behavior of Christian women. When they were treated like this, they did not take vengeance on themselves. They have the glory of chastity within them, the testimony of their conscience. They take this in the sight of God, and they ask for nothing more. They will not deviate from the authority of God's law by taking unlawful steps to avoid the suspicions of men. Now think about this. If there are shadowy resemblances, as I think there are to the two cities in Lucretia and Regulus, there's also a literal contrast between the city of this world and the city of God on pilgrimage. And Christian women who suffered also alongside Roman women, pagan women, who suffered rape and violence against them in the sack of Rome, they turned to trust God. And so they are emblems of the city which is trust divine providence, a city which is humble, a city which obeys, a city which receives grace, which doesn't need to display its virtue, but trust that God knows its virtue, right? That God knows her virtues, right? God knows that she did not consent to these crimes against her, and thus she is interiorly chaste. And this is something that's also a kind of new custom, is to think about an interior chastity. That Augustine thinks even the raped woman has a kind of interior chastity if she did not consent to the rape. Right? And that this is visible to God, that God sees the heart. Heart speaks to heart. Great motto of Cardinal Newman. The heart is its own witness before God. And so Christian women model the presence of a superior city, a city which is actually going to be better for Rome, a city which trusts God is going to be better for Rome, a city which trusts God is going to be more lawful, isn't going to break the law, right? The Lucretia's broken the law, the literal Roman law, by being her own judge and executioner. But Christian women are actually, because they hold to a higher law, they can actually more perfectly follow lower human laws. It's a very interesting side argument. They will not deviate from the authority of God's law by taking unlawful steps. Right? Very interesting. Okay, so that's a very brief contrast between the two cities. And now to the example of Regulus. Regulus is a very successful Roman military man. Anybody know about Regulus? Yeah?
Well, he was captured by the Carthaginians. They made him swear an oath to go to Rome and then come back if the deal isn't made. He does that. After he fails, he leaves Rome, even though he's there by himself. So he needs to escape. He goes back to Rome.
Beautiful. So, he's a very successful general who's won great battles in the First Punic War, but now the Carthaginians have captured him, they seize on this opportunity. They have the great man. Right? The Carthaginians have the great man, and they're going to use him. They're going to use him to try to secure or broker some kind of political deal with Rome that's beneficial to the Carthaginians. Right? And so they make this deal, as you say, that he should go back to the Senate, he should discuss the terms of a peace treaty, with the certain effect of if he secures the peace treaty, he also secures his own freedom. If he doesn't secure the peace treaty, he must return to the Carthaginians, who will almost certainly kill him. So he goes to the Senate, he presents the peace treaty, and he says, here's the terms, and then he tells the senators, but don't take the deal. It's a bad deal. It's bad for the common good of Rome. Knowing full well that means he goes back and dies for the common good of Rome. The Roman senators say, commit suicide. This is going to be easier. You know how painful they're going to make your death when you go back to the Carthaginians? He says, no, I'm not going to commit suicide. So this redounds to Regulus. Right? Augustine is praising this. Just as he's critical of Lucretia, he's praising Regulus for this kind of virtue. He's acting on behalf of the common good of Rome. And as you say, he's also doing it by way of an oath to the gods. So let's talk about that. He proceeded to Rome, and since the deal wasn't to the advantage of Rome, he asked them to reject it. Since he had taken an oath to the gods, he voluntarily fulfilled his obligation to go back under arrest, and the enemy put him to death with every refinement of dreadful torture. The Carthaginians put Regulus in a box with nails and spikes, they basically, it's death by sleep deprivation. When you finally collapse, you collapse on spikes, and so this is how Regulus dies. He dies in a sense. A terrible kind of suicide torture, forced suicide torture. Our enemies are certainly right to praise a courage which rose superior to so dreadful a fate. And yet he is sworn by those gods, the prohibition of whose worship has led, in their opinion, to the infliction of these recent disasters on the human race. This is an interesting sentence in Chapter 15 here, that Augustine's says they're certainly right to praise his courage. Okay. There's a virtue there, the virtue of courage. They're right to praise the virtue of courage. Right? Augustine's critical of the virtue of honor in the way that it plays out with Lucretia. But over here with Regulus, the virtue of courage is commended. So it's not that all pagan virtues are always vicious all the way down. It's that it depends on how those virtues are ordered, to what end they're ordered. He praises his courage, his fortitude, and it's a fortitude that is there even though he's worshiping the wrong gods. It's a virtue that's there even though he's attached to false religio, false religion. I can conclude by reasoning two lines of argument. Regulus venerated the gods, And the result was that because of his oath, he did not stay in his own country, but went without the least hesitation, not to any place he chose, but back to his fiercest enemies. It was not because he clung to life that he refused suicide. I'm going to skip this one. Among all the heroes, men worthy of honor and renowned for virtue, the Romans have none greater to produce. Such heroes of Rome fought for their earthly country. The gods they worshipped were false, but their worship was genuine, and they faithfully kept their oaths. Christians worship the true God and yearn for the heavenly country. Will they not have more reason to refrain from the crime of suicide? Take this, the first half of this sentence. Heroes like Regulus are worthy of honor and they're renowned for virtues, and the Romans have none greater to produce. And he says, incredibly, their worship was genuine. Now, what could that mean for Augustine? Right? They're worshiping false gods. Can he mean that their worship of false gods is genuine? It seems that he means that they have something like the right intent. The right intent to, not only is Regulus recognizing that the common good of Rome is worth self-sacrifice for, is worth laying your life down for your friends, but there's also an intent on Regulus' part to recognize something even higher than the Roman common good, a transcendent common good. Now, that object of worship for Regulus is false. He has a false god. But Augustine here is saying there's something laudable in his intention to worship something greater than himself. Right? This is also not the stereotypical Augustine. Right? Augustine's absolutely against idolatry. He's absolutely against the Roman god. But he's putting his finger on something virtuous. Something virtuous. He's praising Regulus' courage. He's praising his fortitude. He's praising his recognition that it's not just about his virtues, but about the virtues of the Roman Republic and the good of the Roman Republic, and then a higher good than the Roman Republic. And that's what Augustine's putting his hand. That's what's genuine. He has the wrong object of worship, but his intention is right and worthy. This is what I think Augustine doesn't think Regulus is saved. He thinks he's a pagan who's going to hell. But he thinks that there's still virtue here. Right? There's still a foothold for the city of God. These are shadowy resemblances of the city of God in the earthly city. Right? There are things in the earthly city, in the fallen world, which are goods. The city of God must work differently. Christians must worship differently. They must worship the true God. And worshiping the true God is going to be better for Rome because they have the right object of worship. This theme will run all the way through the city of God, that the good of the res publica requires true religio. Res publica requires true religio. Res publica always has religio. A res publica cannot help but have a religio. Regulus has a religio. Lucretia has a religio. One very bad religio for Lucretia and a better religio for Regulus, but still not a religio that attaches him to the true object of worship, and so thus not a salvific religio. Similarly, for Rome, Rome must be the res publica that is attached to true religio if it is to flourish. That false religio is going to lead to false morals, and that's going to lead to a false politics. We must show how the true God, in whose power are all kingdoms, the very source of the power of Rome is God, the true God. And all the blessings that Rome has enjoyed, Augustine says, come from that God. Come from the true God. All the blessings of Rome. Why is Rome great? Why has Rome flourished? Well, that's all been because of the true God. The true God has brought all the blessings of Rome, and it's the false gods who brought all the suffering. It's false morals that bring the suffering. And so he's flipped the argument that instead of saying Christianity's to blame, he's saying, no, no, no. It's bad theology that's to blame. It's false worship that's to blame. It's pride which is to blame. It's the libido dominandi. It's the heart turned in on itself. That's what's to blame. That's what causes Roman decline. When any temporal disaster comes, the Christian answer is this. And so this is why I say the first book is very much a kind of response to suffering. Roman suffering, but also individual suffering. How we think about suffering. How does the Christian think about suffering versus how, the Stoic thinks about suffering? When any temporal disaster comes, he says in chapter 29, the Christian's answer is this. My God is present everywhere. And wholly present everywhere. No limits confine him. He can be present without showing himself. He can depart without moving. When I am troubled with adversity, he is either testing my worth or punishing my faults. And he has an eternal reward in store for me in return for loyal endurance of temporal distress. Now, the Roman suicide is a great exemplar for thinking about how does pagan Rome deal with suffering. Well, the Roman way of dealing with suffering is that you increase the injustice, you increase the suffering. The suicide's a perfect example of that. He says, but the Christian's humility, the Christian's trust in divine providence is not really a weakness, but a strength. The Christian humility is actually something that actually will paradoxically make Rome stronger. Less inclined to increase the injustice. Less inclined to a kind of vengeance. Less inclined give an improper response to suffering. So the city of God is the presence of this disposition towards suffering in which you trust God's providence. You trust that God, in permitting suffering, is either testing the faithful or punishing the wicked. So you better think of your suffering as testing the faithful. Unless it actually is punishing something wicked that you've done. She must bear in mind that among these very enemies, Augustine's very aware that the church has enemies and that the enmity is real. But among these very enemies are hidden future citizens of the city of God. This goes back to the theme of conversion, that Augustine's, why is Augustine making this argument to Rome to convert them? He wants to move their souls to see that the good of Rome is best served by Christianity. The good of Rome is best served by the virtues of humility and not the libido dominandi. She must bear in mind that among these enemies are hidden her future citizens, and when confronted with them, she must not think it a fruitless task to bear with their hostility. This is a really interesting line that Augustine thinks the Christian actually shouldn't be surprised at facing hostility. In fact, facing hostility is something, an opportunity to bear witness to God's providence, and that this is good for Rome. She shouldn't think it a fruitless task to bear with their hostility until she finds them confessing the faith. So he also speaks of what is the end of the city of God on pilgrimage, while it makes this pilgrimage, is for conversion, right? Is to bring the enemies to the confession of faith. And this is the presence of the city of God in the Roman city, is to bring about the confession of faith, and that the confession of faith will also be good for Rome. Not in an instrumental way, but just in an actual way, that Res Publica needs true religio. In the same way, while the city of God is on pilgrimage in this world, she has in her midst some who are united with her in participation in the sacraments, but who will not join her with her in the eternal destiny of the saints. So now we see the two cities also in the church for Augustine. But there's two cities in the church who are commingled together, as we'll hear again in Book 19. The two cities are commingled together like the wheat and the tares, right? Jesus says we'll grow up together. The wheat and tares will grow up together. And as we've seen in the McCarrick scandal and everything, we're perfectly aware of that. We're perfectly aware of the city of man that grows up in the midst of the city of God. And so Augustine's an equal opportunity two cities storyteller. He tells the two cities in a kind of shadowy resemblance in Roman history, and he tells the two cities in a more literal way in terms of Christian exemplars and pagan exemplars. And then he tells the two cities also in terms, as we'll see, in the life of Israel, as we'll see in Book 15, and also in the life of the church, there's two cities. So the two cities narrative is a real one. It runs all the way through, but it's more complicated than we often hear it. Finally, I want to read to you something from a letter that Augustine wrote, which I think puts Book 1 in a certain perspective that I like. I think it's a Catholic perspective on the city of God. Letter 138, a very famous letter. And he writes, "The first Romans indeed used their virtues to establish and enlarge the commonwealth, even if they failed to show the sort of true piety for the true God through its saving religion." Also lead them, even if they failed to show the sort of true piety for the true God that could, through its saving religion, also lead them to the eternal city, the real eternal city. However, they still protected their own sort of integrity, which was adequate for establishing, enlarging, and preserving their earthly city. They still protected their own sort of integrity, which was adequate for establishing, enlarging, and preserving their earthly city. If you know your Aquinas, you know this is the sort of thing where there's a certain acquired virtues that human beings can have, which serve the city perfectly well. The harvesting of vineyards can all be done without supernatural grace, and Augustine sounds a bit like that here. Their own sort of integrity. "For God revealed in the wealth and fame of the Roman Empire how powerful are civic virtues even without true religion." Right. This is echoes of Regulus here in this letter. Right? That Rome is to be admired when it is being virtuous. When it is being virtuous, even though those virtues are not attached to the supreme good by true religio, they're still to be praised. They still do good things in the world. And he says, okay, why does God permit that? To make it clear that with the addition of true religion, human beings become citizens of the other city, whose king is truth, whose law is love, and whose limit is eternity. That is, that when one is united to true religio, it elevates, it perfects and elevates. It heals, of course, the wounded aspects of our nature, but also perfects and elevates human nature, and also the common good is elevated by that attachment to true religio. So in the first book of the City of God, Augustine gives us in Nuce many of the major themes of the whole work. And of course he knows this is written over 17 years or something, and it comes out in fits and starts, and he knows that the first book will probably be read before the rest. And so there's aspects of the whole work in the first book. So it's really important to pay close attention to these exemplars and how the two cities are working. Augustine does not have a simple contrast, right, between Rome and the church. He just doesn't. The two cities is a complex idea. I think that's all. That's my hour, but we have time for questions, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I wonder how you'd respond to kind of an alternative. I think this last letter might undermine what I'm going to try to argue, but It seems like to me what the story of Regulus, what he was getting at, especially in chapter 15, mm-hmm. is saying we shouldn't necessarily expect good temporal goods from mm-hmm. God. Even the best Romans, you know, don't expect. He wasn't being true to his oath because he expected, you know, temporal happiness. You know, he knew he wasn't going to get that, and still he was faithful. So I guess that to me, it runs a little bit counter to your argument about his emphasizing the not quite not elevated common good, but still a common good worth dying for and everything. That, I don't know. What do you think about that? It seems to me that's what he was emphasizing there.
What do you think of the sentence on page 25 of the Bettinson, middle of the page? Second full paragraph, again, if they say that Marcus Regulus would have been happy in the possession of a virtuous spirit even in captivity and during those physical torments, then let us aim at true virtue, which can bring happiness also to a community. For the source of a community's felicity is no different from that of one man, since a community is simply a united multitude of individuals. What do you think of that sentence, that couple sentences there?
No, I do see the sort of encouragement to aim at virtue, which brings a certain kind of happiness both to an individual and community.
But there's an ambivalence there too, right? If then let us aim at true virtue, which can bring the happiness also to a community. Regulus preferred to be deprived of all these external advantages rather than to offend the gods by whom he had sworn. How do you read that?
That, again, to me, it seems like he's not looking for external advantages in his devotion to the gods.
Mm-hmm.
He's, and that's why he's saying this is true, you know, this is sort of his religion, I think you said, was genuine, or something like that.
His worship is genuine.
His worship is genuine. So again, in here, at the end of this section here, our components are compelled by this notable example to admit that the gods are not to be worshipped for the sake of physical blessings or external advantages. And it seems like that, to me, is important, what he's getting at, that don't say Christian rule was bad because a bad thing happened, you know, Rome was sacked and all this stuff, that's not even the point, the ultimate point of, and it's actually kind of an interesting
yeah.
argument, you know.
So, the question is whether or not happiness, whether or not you can be happy in suffering, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does happiness mean the absence of all suffering, is the question, right? Clearly, happiness goes with the virtue in a certain philosophical framework. If you're Epicurean, you think that happiness goes with pleasure, right? So clearly Augustine and Regulus don't think happiness goes with pleasure and thus the absence of all suffering. But happiness goes with the virtue, right? And so I think you're right to put your finger on this, because Augustine doesn't think that it means, after all, the good and the wicked alike will suffer. Right? So the good and the wicked alike will suffer, but the happiness goes with the virtue. Right? The happiness is attached to the virtue. Sorry, yeah, go
there.
Our moral theologian here.
No problem. This is great stuff, right? I mean, Regulus is a wonderful example. I'm not sure to what extent you guys are disagreeing or like what's the
Yeah, I'm just curious how he reads it.
Like, I kind of read it the same way you do, right? He's making a comparison, right, between, as you said, Chad, between Rome, right, as Romans understand themselves and the kind of community they are, and what he thinks a true city, you know, et cetera, should be like. And he's using Regulus as an example to point to the Romans, like, look, your own, the guy you venerate, right, the guy you consider virtuous understands what we Christians understand.
Right.
Worship of the true God does not guarantee temporal felicity, right? And he knows that. So he's willing to go back and suffer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regulus, and Augustine's saying, why on the one hand do you venerate the guy, but you don't want to be the kind of city, right, that recognizes as well that your worship
right.
of the gods will not guarantee temporal felicity, right? Be, right, be the city that recognizes the guy is virtuous, right, and also recognizes, right, that your worship will not guarantee you things, because that's what you're criticizing the Christians.
Exactly.
You're saying, right, like, now because we're all Christian, right, you know, things are collapsing around us, and you know, and so forth, right? Is that kind of the point you're trying to make?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, it's so, in a sense,
yeah.
It's like, what, I'm not sure what the disagreement
no,
is.
No, I don't think it's a disagreement. I think Regulus is an exemplar of a foothold for the city of God. Right.
Regulus is what makes Regulus' worship interesting, right, is that it's an approximation, right, of, well, I mean, that's the genuine language,
yeah.
Right, which would be wonderful to know what the Latin term is at that
mm-hmm.
point, right? Like, is it, I doubt it's genuine, right? It's probably something more like praiseworthy or commendable, but it would be interesting to know, right?
Yeah.
There's something about his faith that is like what we Christians believe, right? Regulus exemplifies that, whereas you guys can't wrap your head around it, right, fully. You're praising him, and you don't even realize why, right?
This thing that you praise is analogous to this thing that you're despising, right?
Sort of.
Right? This thing that you're praising in Regulus is analogous to the Christianity that...
You can't praise it with backing into an acceptance of what we understand about the right form, what
yeah.
God's relationships are to temporal felicity.
Yeah. Yeah,
And it's really wonderful, right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it's wonderful, again, you know, playing with, right, the Romans' own veneration.
Right.
You're venerating, right? I get that. We understand
yeah.
that. But, you know, if you don't even understand what you're praising. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I love this.
Yeah, it's really,
right.
really rich. And the contrast between Lucretia and Regulus is very rich, too. But, yeah, I think the it can't be that he thinks that it's a recipe for not suffering if 1:8 is the thesis, right? That the good and the bad are going to suffer alike. And it's not the nature of the suffering that matters, but the nature of the sufferer. It's a bit of a virtue ethics kind of thesis. Yes, over here.
Just a quick question. So he argues that, you know, virtues can be attained outside of Christianity, but Christianity sort of validates these virtues. And perfects them in a way. How would Regulus' virtues be perfected in a way through Christianity? Is it just the object of the sacrifice that is being made that changes the sacrifice itself, or is there something transcendent that could be added to the story?
Right, so the acquired virtue of religion there, which he is an approximation or is something genuine, is not hitting its target, right? It's not getting attached, and we'll talk about this tomorrow when we talk about Book 10. Augustine likes the adhorare image, this adhesive. There's no bond. There's nothing to bind his genuine worship to the supreme good, which has been revealed in Jesus Christ. And so Jesus Christ is the one who would take what he's offering to the transcendent and perfect it and elevate it.
Exactly.
Right?
So then, the whole argument...
But by giving it the true object, right? Because he lacks the true object.
Right.
So, in a sense, we're worshiping animals. He's a religious animal. He's recognizing that as a natural precept of his existence. And so that's what's genuine. But he can't get it attached to the good. This is going to be his big argument against the Platonists. If the Platonists can see the supreme good, but they have no way... In fact, they have very improper means of attaching... being attached to the supreme good.
But Chad, real quick, but as you set up, right, like, he's not interested in Regulus' virtue here, right, but he says that, right, like, I don't know what Regulus thought when Regulus is going back,
mm-hmm.
right, Regulus may have thought, my gods are going to protect me and I'm going to somehow get out of this, right, but Augustine's like, look, that's not the point is about the city, the point is the comparison of the communities, right, you guys are venerating somebody who shows you that your gods don't protect you and don't, right, and worship of your gods do not guarantee
mm-hmm.
temporal felicity. Right? That, the point is about the gods.
I think that's true. I think he also has a line in there that mentions that Regulus is doing this for the common good. And he credits that as virtuous. Doing it for the res publica.
But he said that. All I'm saying is that he is not yet concerned about the question of what their virtues look like. Because he
yes.
says, I'm not talking about Regulus' virtues right now, because I don't know what he thought, right?
Right, but I'm trying to connect it back to what we were talking about, the suffering, and, you know, the sort of of suffering as not being incompatible with happiness. And so it seems that the happiness that one can attain without Christianity is a sort of limited happiness. It's not true happiness in a way. If
that,
you're not attaching it to the truest good.
That the happiness that even virtue brings,
exactly,
right, is not a happiness that's a true happiness because it's not united to the supreme felicity.
Right. So
yeah.
even the
that is the argument.
Yeah. So even the virtuosity
isn't truly happy.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're going to see this tomorrow when we talk about his argument with Cicero, what's required for a complete republic. What's required for the happiness of a republic is to be attached. Mm-hmm. Yes?
It may also have to do with the virtue of hope, right? Because we've discussed Regulus mostly as an example of courage.
Mm-hmm.
But what suicide is the ultimate way to take the result of your action into your own hands and
mm-hmm.
say, I will define
right.
the result. And that's part of Lucretia's failure. She can't see any prospect for hope beyond, you know, controlling her own end.
Mm-hmm.
And Regulus sort of submits to letting that be out of his control,
mm-hmm.
which connects to the broader argument about providential hope,
mm-hmm.
it seems.
Mm-hmm. But there's some analog to that, maybe even in him hoping that the gods might save him. There's some kind of analog to true hope.
Clearly,
yeah.
But there's some analog.
Yeah. I don't want to overdo his praise of Regulus. I mean, he doesn't really... Regulus isn't... Socrates is closer to a proto-martyr than Regulus, but he doesn't really have proto-martyrs in the way that some thinkers do. Yes, over here.
Sorry, I just... One detail about the story of Regulus that I didn't quite understand was, is he kind of saying that Regulus is kind of, because he saying, like, because worshipping those gods, they don't promise an afterlife. So, but Regulus is acting as if his actions will matter after he dies. He's not like, well, I'll just go live out my life happily. He's like, I will keep my oath and then I'll die. So it's almost like he's sort of inferred that his actions do matter beyond his death. If that makes sense? Because like for a Christian to do that, you'd be like, okay, well, they obviously have a hope and that's how they're understanding their own action. But where he's saying he's worshipping these gods, but these gods don't even, like he's not doing it to get any promises. So he's almost, like the Platonists, he's almost inferred something that is metaphorically correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't sure whether
yeah.
that made sense in the
historical. I mean, I guess it doesn't give us enough information about his view of Regulus, and I don't know enough about Regulus to know what he thinks about the immortality of the soul. He probably believes in the immortality of the soul, but I don't know that. But yeah, that, I think there could be an analog there if that's what you're seeing. Yes?
Yeah, kind of in line with that question, I was just trying to think about how at the end of book one, when he is talking about who he's going to have the debate with.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, section chapter 36, we shall have to engage with philosophers and philosophers of no ordinary sort, but those who enjoy the most eminent reputation amongst our adversaries and who are in agreement with us on many points.
Yeah.
On the immortality of the soul, on God's creation of the universe, and on his providence which governs his creation.
Yeah.
So he says, I can't really engage, and I think he repeats this throughout the book, I can't really engage like the atheists or the people who think the gods don't care about the city.
Yeah.
And so in line with that question, I was kind of thinking, well, in order for Regulus's action to really be for the sake of the common good, it makes sense to me how saying, don't take the deal, it's bad for us. That
it's
would
bad for the Republic.
Right, that would be for the sake of the common good. But you have to presume some kind of that it's somehow good for the entire city to do the virtuous thing, regardless of the practical consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Machiavellian thesis has to be rejected.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this whole debate hinges on the idea of virtue and happiness being connected to doing what is sort of intrinsically good, rather than what is effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe yeah.
tease that out a little more. I'm interested what you mean for this particular example in Rome.
I guess what I'm thinking is that I'm wondering, okay, in this discussion of the city of man versus the city of God, and in this discussion of the virtuous, potentially virtuous city of man, is Augustine able to, like, offer a critique of maybe the Machiavellian principle that you have to, what makes a city good or what is beneficial to the city is, you know, doing what brings the most advantageous consequence. So he's connecting happiness of the city
mm-hmm.
to true virtue,
mm-hmm.
more so than, like, okay, don't take the deal because we're actually going to lose to the Carthaginians if you do that. By the way, I'm a really important general, so I'm not going back there. I don't know the Carthaginians anything. They're our enemies. You need me. I'm staying here in Rome. We're going to regroup. We're going to go back. We're going to beat them.
Mm-hmm.
He's just not really
doesn't take the Machiavellian
engaging that possibility.
Yeah, and later, of course, Augustine will critique this under the image of Thrasymachus. You know, of the
yeah.
the one who just rules by force,
mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of Machiavellian position.
Right.
So this is rule by virtue, and so Regulus is admired because he rules by virtue, and that virtue is actually what's going to lead to the flourishing, and that's probably a better translation
right.
here for felicity is a kind of flourishing.
Yeah. So I guess
which doesn't exclude suffering.
So I guess it makes me wonder about what exactly is the nature of this association that he draws between the happiness of the individual, which comes from being virtuous,
mm-hmm.
even if it is not to your advantage, and the happiness of the city, right?
Mm-hmm.
Drawing that connection between the city and the soul, basically.
Yeah, and of course, and as you rightly note, he's building this all towards the Platonists, which
right.
Romans
yeah.
have a mixed kind of attachment to. And so he's going to build up an argument for why the Platonists really are Roman, why they belong to Rome. He'll do this whole argument in Book
yeah.
8 as to why the Platonists the Platonists really belong to the Roman tradition, and thus they should move away from the polytheism towards the monotheism of the Platonist. But yeah, you're right. The Platonic argument between the soul, the city, and the cosmos is right here, right? That the virtues of the interior soul of an individual, whether a general or a heroine, matter for the good of the city.
Mm-hmm.
That argument is right up front, or it's implied right up front.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.